inside the raucous craft. He put his mouth next to Hattie's ear. "Now what about Chris?" he said. She turned and spoke into his ear. "They wheeled him past us while I was going into the lounge, blood all over." "What happened?" "I don't know, but, Rayford, he didn't look good."
"How bad?"
"I think he was dead. I mean, they were working on him, but I'd be surprised if he made it."
Rayford shook his head. "What next?"
"Did he get hit or something? Did that bus crash?"
"Wouldn't that be ironic?"
"I don't know," she said. "The blood seemed like it was coming from his hand or his waist or both."
Rayford tapped the pilot on the shoulder.
"Do you know anything about First Officer Christopher Smith?" "He with Pan Con?" the pilot said. "Yes." "Was he the suicide?"
Rayford recoiled.
"I don't think so. Was there a suicide?" "Lots of them, I guess, but mostly passengers. Only crew member I heard about was a Smith from Pan. Slit his wrists."
Rayford quickly scanned the others in the chopper to see if he recognized anyone. He didn't, but one was nodding sadly, having overheard the pilot shouting. He leaned forward.
"Chris Smith, you know him?"
"My first officer."
"Sorry."
"What did you hear?"
"Don't know how reliable this is, but the rumor is he found out his boys had disappeared and his wife was killed in a wreck."
For the first time, the enormity of the situation became personal for Rayford. He didn't know Smith well. He vaguely remembered Chris had two sons. Seemed they were young teenagers, very close in age. He had never met the wife. But suicide? Was that an option for Rayford? No, not with Chloe still there. But what if he had discovered that Irene and young Ray were gone and Chloe had been killed? What would he have to live for? He hadn't been living for them anyway, certainly not the last several months. He had been playing around on the edges of his mind with the girl in his lap, though he had never gone so far as touching her, even when she often touched him. Would he want to live if Hattie Durham were the only person he cared about? And why did he care about her? She was beautiful and sexy and smart, but only for her age. They had little in common. Was it only because he was convinced Irene was gone that he now longed to hold his own wife? There was no affection in his embrace of Hattie Durham just now, nor in hers. Both were scared to death, and flirting was the last thing in their minds. The irony was not lost on him. He recalled that the last thing he daydreamed about, before Hattie's announcement, was finally making a move on her. How could he have known she would be in his lap hours later and that he would have no more interest in her than in a stranger? The first stop was the Des Plaines Police Department, where Hattie disembarked. Rayford advised her to ask for a ride home with the police if a squad car was available. Most had been pressed into service in more congested areas, so that was unlikely.
"I'm only about a mile from here anyway," Hattie shouted above the roar as Rayford helped her from the chopper. "I can walk."
She wrapped her arms around his neck in a fierce embrace, and he felt her quiver in fear.
"I hope everyone's okay at your place," she said. "Call me and let me know, okay?"
He nodded.
"Okay?"
she insisted.
"Okay."
As they lifted off, he watched her survey the parking lot. Spotting no squad car, she turned and hurried off, pulling her suitcase on wheels. By the time the helicopter began to swing toward Mount Prospect, Hattie was trotting toward her condominium. Buck Williams had been the first passenger from his flight to reach the terminal at O'Hare. He found a mess. No one waiting in line for a phone would put up with his trying to plug his modem into it, and he couldn't get his cellular phone to work, so he made his way to the exclusive Pan Con Club. It, too, was jammed, but despite a loss of personnel, including the disappearance of several employees while on the job, some semblance of order prevailed. Even here, people waited in line for phones, but as each became available, it was understood that some might try faxing or connecting directly by modem. While Buck waited, he went to work again on his computer, reattaching the inside modem cord to the female connector. Then he called up the messages that he had quickly downloaded before landing. The first was from Steve Plank, his executive editor, addressed to all field personnel. "Stay put. Do not try to come to New York. Impossible here. Call when you can. Check your voicemail and your email regularly. Keep in touch as possible. We have enough staff to remain on schedule, and we want personal accounts, on-the-scene stuff, as much as you can transmit. Not sure of transportation and communication lines between us and our printers, nor their employee levels. If possible, we'll print on time. Just a note. Begin thinking about the causes. Military, cosmic, scientific, spiritual. But so far we're dealing mainly with what happened. Take care and keep in touch." The second message was also from Steve and was for Buck's eyes only. "Buck, ignore general staff memo. Get to New York as soon as you can at any expense. Take care of family matters, of course, and file any personal experience or reflections just like everyone else. But you're going to head up this effort to get at what's behind the phenomenon. Ideas are like egos. Everybody's got one. Whether we'll come to any conclusions, I don't know, but at the very least we'll catalog the reasonable possibilities. You may wonder why we need you here to do this. I do have an ulterior motive. Sometimes I think because of the position I'm in, I'm the only one who knows these things. But three different department editors have turned in story ideas on various international groups meeting in New York this month. Political editor wants to cover a Jewish nationalist conference in Manhattan that has something to do with a New World Order government. What they care about that, I don't know, and the political editor doesn't either. Religion editor has something in my box about a conference of Orthodox Jews also coming for a meeting. These are not just from Israel, but apparently all over, and they are no longer haggling over the Dead Sea Scrolls. They're still giddy over the destruction of Russia and her allies, which I know you still think was supernatural, but hey, I love you anyway. Religion editor thinks they're looking for help in rebuilding the temple. That may be no big deal or have anything to do with anything other than the religion department, but I was struck by the timing. With the other Jewish group meeting at pretty much the same time and at the same place about something entirely political. The other religious conference in town is among leaders of all the major religions, from the standard ones to the New Agers, also talking about a one-world religious order. They ought to get together with the Jewish nationalists, huh? Need your brain on this. Don't know what to make of it, if anything. I know all anybody cares about is the disappearances, but we need to keep an eye on the rest of the world. You know the United Nations has that international monetarist confab coming up, trying to gauge how we're all doing with the three-currency thing. Personally, I like it, but I'm a little skittish about going to one currency unless it's dollars. Can you imagine trading in yen or marks here? Guess I'm still provincial. Everybody's pretty enamored with this Carpathia guy from Romania who so impressed your friend Rosenzweig. He's got everybody in a bind in the upper house in his own country because he's been invited to speak at the UN in a couple of weeks. Nobody knows how he wangled an invitation, but his international popularity reminds me a lot of Wałęsa or even Gorbachev. Remember them? Ha! Hey, friend, get word to me you didn't disappear. As far as I know right now, I lost a niece and two nephews, a sister-in-law I didn't like, and possibly a couple of other distant relatives. You think they'll be back? We'll save that till we get rolling on what's behind this. If I had to guess, I'm anticipating some god-awful ransom demand. I mean, it's not like these people who disappeared are dead. What in the world is going to happen to the life insurance industry? I'm not ready to start believing the tabloids. You just know they're going to be saying the space aliens finally got us. Get in here, Buck. Chapter 4. Buck kept pressing a handkerchief soaked with cold water onto the back of his head. His wound had stopped bleeding, but it stung. He found another message in his email inbox and was about to call it up when he was tapped on the shoulder.
I'm a doctor. Let me dress your wound.
Oh, it's all right, and I...
Just let me do this, pal. I'm going crazy here with nothing to do, and I have my bag. I'm working free today. Call it a rapture special.
A what?
Well, what would you call what happened? The doctor said, removing a bottle and gauze from his bag. This is going to be pretty rudimentary, but we will be sterile. AIDS?
I'm sorry?
Come on, you know the routine.
He snapped on rubber gloves.
Have you got HIV or anything fun like that?
No, and hey, I appreciate this. At that instant, the doctor splashed a heavy dose of disinfectant on the gauze and held it against Buck's scraped head.
Yow! Take it easy!
Be a big boy there, stud. This'll hurt less than the infection you'd get otherwise. He roughly scraped the wound, cleansing it and causing it to ooze blood again.
Listen, I'm going to do a little shave job so I can get a bandage to hold. All right with you?
Buck's eyes were watering.
Yeah, sure, but what was that you said about rapture?
Is there any other explanation that makes sense? The doctor said, using a scalpel to tear into Buck's hair.
A club attendant came by and asked if they could move the operation into one of the washrooms.
I promised to clean up, hon, the doctor said. Almost done here.
Well, this can't be sanitary, and we do have other members to think about.
Why don't you just give them their drinks and nuts, all right? You'll find this just isn't going to upset them that much on a day like this.
I don't appreciate being spoken to that way.
The doctor sighed as he worked.
You're right. What's your name?
Susie.
Listen, Susie, I've been rude and I apologize, okay? Now let me finish this and I promise not to perform any more surgery right out here in public.
Susie left, shaking her head.
Doc, Buck said, leave me your card so I can properly thank you.
No need, the doctor said, putting his stuff away.
Now give me your take on this. What did you mean about the rapture?
Another time. Your turn for the phone.
Buck was torn, but he couldn't pass up the chance to communicate with New York. He tried dialing direct, but couldn't get through.
He hooked his modem up to the phone and initiated repeat dialing while he looked at the message from Steve Plank's secretary, the matronly Marge Potter.
Buck, you scoundrel. Like I don't have enough to do and worry about today, I've got to check on your girlfriend's families. Where did you meet this Hattie Durham? You can tell her I reached her mother out west, but that was before a flood or storm or something knocked phone lines out again. She's perfectly healthy but rattled, and she was very grateful to know her daughter hadn't disappeared. The two sisters are okay, too, according to Mom. You are a dear for helping people like this, Buck. Steve says you're going to try to come in. It'll be good to see you. This is so awful. So far, we know of several staffers who disappeared, several more we haven't heard from, including some in Chicago. Everybody from the senior staff is accounted for now that we've heard from you. I hoped and prayed you'd be all right. Have you noticed it seems to have struck the innocents? Everyone we know who's gone is either a child or a very nice person. On the other hand, some truly wonderful people are still here. I'm glad you're one of them, and so is Steve. Call us. No word whether she had been able to reach Buck's widowed father or married brother. Buck wondered if that was on purpose or if she simply had no news yet. His niece and nephew had to be gone if it was true that no children had survived. Buck gave up trying to reach the office directly, but again successfully connected with his online service. He uploaded his files and a few hastily batted out messages of his whereabouts. That way, by the time the telephone system once again took on some semblance of normalcy, Global Weekly would have already gotten a head start on his stuff. He hung up and disconnected to the grateful look of the next in line, then went looking for that doctor. No luck. Marge had referred to innocence. The doctor assumed it was the rapture. Steve had poo-pooed space aliens. But how could you rule out anything at this point? His mind was already whirring with ideas for the story behind the disappearances. Talk about the assignment of a lifetime.
Buck got in line at the service desk, knowing his odds of getting to New York by conventional means were slim. While he waited, he tried to remember what it was Chaim Rosenzweig, the newsmaker of the year, had told him about the young Nicolae Carpathia of Romania. Buck had told only Steve Plank about it, and Steve agreed it wasn't worth putting in the already tight story. Rosenzweig had been impressed with Carpathia, that was true. But why? Buck sat on the floor in line and moved when he had to. He called up his archived files on the Rosenzweig interview and did a word search on Carpathia. He recalled having been embarrassed to admit to Rosenzweig that he had never heard of the man. As the taped interview transcript scrolled past, he hit the pause button and read. When he noticed his low battery light flashing, he fished an extension cord out of his bag and plugged the computer into a socket along the wall. "Watch the cord," he called out occasionally as people passed. One of the women behind the counter hollered at him that he'd have to unplug. He smiled at her. "And if I don't, are you going to have me thrown out? Arrested? Cut me some slack today of all days." Hardly anyone took note of the crazy man on the floor yelling at the counter woman. Such rarely happened in the PanCon Club, but nothing surprised anyone today. Rayford Steele disembarked on the helipad at Northwest Community Hospital in Arlington Heights, where the pilots had to get off and make room so a patient could be flown to Milwaukee. The other pilots hung around the entrance, hoping to share a cab, but Rayford had a better idea. He began walking. He was about 5 miles from home, and he was betting he could hitch a ride easier than finding a cab. He hoped his captain's uniform and his clean-cut appearance would set someone's mind at ease about giving him a ride. As he trudged along, his trench coat over his arm and his bag in his hand, he had an empty, despairing feeling. By now, Hattie would be getting to her condo, checking her messages, trying to get calls through to her family. If he was right that Irene and Ray Jr. were gone, where would they have been when it happened? Would he find evidence that they had disappeared rather than being killed in some related accident? Rayford calculated that the disappearances would have taken place late evening, perhaps around 11 p.m. Central Time. Would anything have taken them away from home at that hour? He couldn't imagine what, and he doubted it. A woman of about 40 stopped for Rayford on Algonquin Road. When he thanked her and told her where he lived, she said she knew the area. "A friend of mine lives there. Well, lived there. Lee Ng, the Asian girl on Channel 7 News." "I know her and her husband," Rayford said. "They still live on our street." "Not anymore. They dedicated the noon newscast to her today. The whole family is gone." Rayford exhaled loudly. "This is unbelievable. Have you lost people?" "'Fraid so," she said, her voice quavery. "About a dozen nieces and nephews." "Wow. You?" "I don't know yet. I'm just getting back from a flight, and I haven't been able to reach anybody." "Do you want me to wait for you?" "No, I have a car. If I need to go anywhere, I'll be all right." "O'Hare's closed, you know," she said. "Really? Since when?" "They just announced it on the radio. Runways are full of planes, terminals full of people, roads full of cars." "Tell me about it." As the woman drove, sniffling, into Mount Prospect, Rayford felt fatigue he had never endured before. Every few houses had driveways jammed with cars, people milling about. It appeared everyone everywhere had lost someone. He knew he would soon be counted among them. "Can I offer you anything?" he asked the woman as she pulled into his driveway. She shook her head. "I'm just glad to have been able to help. You could pray for me if you think of it. I don't know if I can endure this." "I'm not much for praying," Rayford admitted. "You will be," she said. "I never was before either, but I am now." "Then you can pray for me," he said. "I will. Count on it." Rayford stood in the driveway and waved to the woman till she was out of sight. The yard and the walk were spotless as usual, and the huge home, his trophy house, was sepulchral. He unlocked the front door. From the newspaper on the stoop, to the closed drapes in the picture window, to the bitter smell of burned coffee when he opened the door, everything pointed to what he dreaded. Irene was a fastidious housekeeper. Her morning routine included the coffee pot on a timer kicking on at 6, percolating her special blend of decaf with an egg. The radio was set to come on at 6:30, tuned to the local Christian station. The first thing Irene did when she came downstairs was open the drapes at the front and back of the house. With a lump in his throat, Rayford tossed the newspaper into the kitchen and took his time hanging up his coat and sliding his bag into the closet. He remembered the package Irene had mailed him at O'Hare and put it in his wide uniform pocket. He would carry it with him as he searched for evidence that she had disappeared. If she was gone, he sure hoped she had been right. He wanted above all else for her to have seen her dream realized, for her to have been taken away by Jesus in the twinkling of an eye, a thrilling, painless journey to his side in heaven, as she always loved to say. She deserved that if anybody did. And Ramey, where would he be? With her? Of course. He went with her to church even when Rayford didn't go. He seemed to like it, to get into it. He even read his Bible and studied it. Rayford unplugged the coffee pot that had been turning itself off and then back on for 7 hours and had ruined the brew. He dumped the mess and left the pot in the sink. He flicked off the radio, which was piping the Christian station's network news hookup into the air, droning on about the tragedy and mayhem that had resulted from the disappearances. He looked about the living room, dining room, and kitchen, expecting to see nothing but the usual neatness of Irene's home. His eyes filling with tears, he opened the drapes as she would have. Was it possible she had gone somewhere, visited someone, left him a message? But if she had, and he did find her, what would that say about her own faith? Would that prove this was not the rapture she believed in? Or would it mean she was lost, just like he was? For her sake, if this was the rapture, he hoped she was gone. But the ache and the emptiness were already overwhelming. He switched on the answering machine and heard all the same messages he had heard when he had gotten through from O'Hare, plus the message he had left. His own voice sounded strange to him. He detected in it a fatalism, as if he knew he was not leaving a message for his wife and son, but only pretending to. He dreaded going upstairs. He moseyed through the family room to the garage exit. If only one of the cars was missing, and one was. Maybe she had gone somewhere, but as soon as he thought of it, Rayford slumped onto the step just inside the garage. It was his own BMW that was gone. The one he had driven to O'Hare the day before. It would be waiting for him when the traffic cleared. The other two cars were there, Irene's and the one Chloe used when she was home. And all those memories of Ramey were there, too. His four-wheeler, his snowmobile, his bike. Rayford hated himself for his broken promises to spend more time with Ramey. He'd have plenty of time to regret that. Rayford stood and heard the rattle of the envelope in his pocket. It was time to go upstairs. It was nearly Buck Williams's turn at the head of the line at the Pan Con Club counter when he found the material he had been looking for on disc. At some point during their several days of taping, Buck had raised the issue of every other country trying to curry favor with Dr. Rosenzweig and hoping to gain access to his formula for its own gain. "This has been an interesting aspect," Rosenzweig had allowed, his eyes twinkling. "I was most amused by a visit from the Vice President of the United States himself. He wanted to honor me, to bring me to the President, to have a parade, to confer a degree, all that. He diplomatically said nothing about my owing him anything in return, but I would owe him everything, would I not? Much was said about what a friend of Israel the United States has been over the decades, and this has been true, no? How could I argue? But I pretended to see the awards and kindnesses as all for my own benefit, and I humbly turned them down. Because, you see, young man, I am most humble, am I not?
The old man had laughed uproariously at himself and relayed several other stories of visiting dignitaries who worked at charming him. Was anyone sincere? Buck had asked. Did anyone impress you?
Yes, Rosenzweig had said without hesitation.
From the most perplexing and surprising corner of the world. Romania. I do not know if he was sent or came on his own, but I suspect the latter, because I believe he is the lowest-ranking official I entertained following the award. That is one of the reasons I wanted to see him. He asked for the audience himself. He did not go through typical political and protocol channels. And he was Nikolai Carpathia.
Carpathia, like the...
Yes, like the Carpathian Mountains. A melodic name, you must admit. I found him most charming and humble, not unlike myself.
Again he had laughed.
I've not heard of him. You will, you will. Buck had tried to lead the old man.
Because he's impressive. That's all I can say.
And he's some sort of a low-level diplomat at this point?
He is a member of the lower house of Romanian government.
In the Senate?
No, the Senate is the upper house.
Of course.
Don't feel bad that you don't know. Even though you are an international journalist, this is something only Romanians and amateur political scientists like me know. That is something I like to study.
In your spare time.
Precisely. But even I had not known of this man. I mean, I knew someone in the House of Deputies, that's what they call the lower house in Romania, was a peacemaker and leading a movement toward disarmament. But I did not know his name. I believe his goal is global disarmament, which we Israelis have come to distrust. But of course he must first bring about disarmament in his own country, which not even you will see in your lifetime. This man is about your age, by the way. Blonde and blue-eyed, like the original Romanians who came from Rome before the Mongols affected their race.
What did you like so much about him?
Let me count, Rosenzweig had said. He knew my language as well as his own. And he speaks fluent English, several others also, they tell me. Well-educated, but also widely self-taught. And I just like him as a person, very bright, very honest, very open.
What did he want from you?
That was what I liked the best, because I found him so open and honest, I asked him outright that question. He insisted I call him Nikolai. And so I said, Nikolai, this is after an hour of pleasantries, what do you want from me?
Do you know what he said, young man?
He said, Dr. Rosenzweig, I seek only your goodwill. What could I say? I said, Nikolai, you have it. I am a bit of a pacifist myself, you know, not unrealistically. I did not tell him this. I merely told him he had my goodwill, which is something you also have.
I suspect that is not something you bestow easily.
That is why I like you, and why you have it. One day you must meet Carpathia. You would like each other. His goals and dreams may never be realized, even in his own country, but he is a man of high ideals. If he should emerge, you will hear of him. And as you are emerging in your own orbit, he will likely hear of you, or from you. Am I right?
I hope you are.
Suddenly it was Buck's turn at the counter. He gathered up his extension cord and thanked the young woman for bearing with him. "Sorry about that," he said, pausing briefly for forgiveness that was not forthcoming. "It's just that today, of all days, well, you understand." Apparently she did not understand. She'd had a rough day, too. She looked at him tolerantly and said, "What can I not do for you?" "Oh, you mean because I did not do something you asked?" "No," she said. "I'm saying that to everybody. It's my little joke, because there's really nothing I can do for anybody. No flights are scheduled today. The airport is going to close any minute. Who knows how long it will take to clear all the wreckage and get any kind of traffic moving again. I mean, I'll take your request and everything, but I can't get your luggage, book you a flight, get you a phone, book you a hotel room, anything we love to do for our members. You are a member, aren't you?"
"Am I a member?
Gold or platinum? Lady, I'm like a kryptonite member." He flashed his card, showing that he was among the top 3% of air travelers in the world. If any flight had one seat in the cheapest section, it had to be given to him and upgraded to first class at no charge. "Oh, my gosh," she said. "Tell me you're not the Cameron Williams from that magazine."
"I am."
"Time? Honest?"
"Don't blaspheme. I'm from the competition."
"Oh, I knew that. The reason I know is that I wanted to get into journalism. I studied it in college. I just read about you, didn't I? Youngest award winner or most cover stories by someone under 12?
Funny.
Or something."
"I can't believe we're joking on a day like this," he said. She suddenly clouded over.
"I don't even want to think about it. So what could I do for you if I could do anything?"
"Here's the thing," Buck said. "I have to get to New York. Now, don't give me that look. I know it's the worst place to try to get to right now. But you know people. You know pilots who fly on the side, charter stuff. You know what airports they would fly out of. Let's say I had unlimited resources and could pay whatever I needed to. Who would you send me to?"
She stared at him. "I can't believe you asked me that."
"Why?"
"Because I do know someone. He flies these little jets out of, like, Waukegan and Palwaukee airports. He's expensive, and he's the type who would charge double during a crisis, especially if he knew who you were and how desperate."
"There won't be any hiding that. Give me the info."
Hearing it on the radio or seeing it on television was one thing. Encountering it for yourself was something else again. Rayford Steele had no idea how it would feel to find evidence that his own wife and son had vanished from the face of the earth. At the top of the stairs, he paused by the family photos. Irene, always one for order, had hung them chronologically, beginning with his and her great-grandparents, old, cracked black and whites of stern-faced, raw-boned men and women of the Midwest. Then came the faded color shots of their grandparents on their 50th wedding anniversaries. Then their parents, their siblings, and themselves. How long had it been since he had studied their wedding photo, her with her flip hairstyle and him with his hair over his ears and mutton chops? And those family pictures with Chloe, 8 years old, holding the baby. How grateful he was that Chloe was still here and that somehow he would connect with her. But what did this all say about the two of them? They were lost. He didn't know what to hope and pray for. That Irene and Raimi were still here and that this was not what it appeared? He could wait no longer. Raimi's door was open a crack. His alarm was beeping. Rayford turned it off. On the bed was a book Raimi had been reading. Rayford slowly pulled the blankets back to reveal Raimi's bull's pajama top, his underpants, and his socks. He sat on the bed and wept, nearly smiling at Irene's harping about Raimi's not wearing socks to bed. He laid the clothes in a neat pile and noticed a picture of himself on the bed table. He stood smiling inside the terminal, his cap tucked under his arm, a 747 outside the window in the background. The picture was signed, "To Raimi with Love, Dad." Under that he had written, Rayford Steele, Captain, Pan-Continental Airlines, O'Hare. He shook his head. What kind of a dad autographs a picture for his own son? Rayford's body felt like lead. It was all he could do to force himself to stand, and then he was dizzy, realizing he hadn't eaten in hours. He slowly made his way out of Ramey's room without looking back, and he shut the door. At the end of the hall, he paused before the French doors that led to the master suite. What a beautiful, frilly place Irene had made it, decorated with needlepoint and country knick-knacks. Had he ever told her he appreciated it? Had he ever appreciated it? There was no alarm to turn off here. The smell of coffee had always roused Irene. Another picture of the two of them, him looking confidently at the camera, her gazing at him. He didn't deserve her. He deserved this, he knew, to be mocked by his own self-centeredness and to be stripped of the most important person in his life. He approached the bed, knowing what he would find. The indented pillow, the wrinkled covers. He could smell her, though he knew the bed would be cold. He carefully peeled back the blankets and sheet to reveal her locket, which carried a picture of him. Her flannel nightgown, the one he always kidded her about and which she wore only when he wasn't home, evidenced her now departed form. His throat tight, his eyes full, he noticed her wedding ring near the pillow, where she always supported her cheek with her hand. It was too much to bear, and he broke down. He gathered the ring into his palm and sat on the edge of the bed, his body racked with fatigue and grief. He put the ring in his jacket pocket and noticed the package she had mailed. Tearing it open, he found two of his favorite homemade cookies with hearts drawn on the top in chocolate. What a sweet, sweet woman, he thought. I never deserved her, never loved her enough. He set the cookies on the bedside table, their essence filling the air. With wooden fingers he removed his clothes and let them fall to the floor. He climbed into the bed and lay face down, gathering Irene's nightgown in his arms so he could smell her and imagine her close to him. And Rayford cried himself to sleep. Chapter 5. Buck Williams ducked into a stall in the PanCon Club men's room to double-check his inventory. Tucked in a special pouch inside his jeans, he carried thousands of dollars worth of traveler's checks, redeemable in dollars, marks, or yen. His one leather bag contained two changes of clothes, his laptop, cellular phone, tape recorder, accessories, toiletries, and some serious insulated winter gear. He had packed for a 10-day trip to Britain when he left New York 3 days before the apocalyptic disappearances. His practice overseas was to do his own laundry in the sink and let it dry a whole day while wearing one outfit and having one more in reserve. That way he was never burdened with lots of luggage. Buck had gone out of his way to stop in Chicago first to mend fences with the Global Weekly's bureau chief there, a 50-ish black woman named Lucinda Washington. He had gotten crossways with her, what else was new, when he scooped her staff on, of all things, a sports story that was right under their noses. An aging Bears legend had finally found enough partners to help him buy a professional football team, and Buck had somehow sniffed it out, tracked him down, gotten the story, and run with it. "I admire you, Cameron," Lucinda Washington had said, characteristically refusing to use his nickname. "I always have, as irritating as you can be. But the very least you should have done was let me know." "And let you assign somebody who should have been on top of this anyway?" "Sports isn't even your gig, Cameron. After doing the Newsmaker of the Year and covering the defeat of Russia by Israel, or I should say by God himself, how can you even get interested in penny-ante stuff like this? You Ivy League types aren't supposed to like anything but lacrosse and rugby, are you?" This was bigger than a sports story, Lucy, and... "Hey, sorry, Lucinda. And wasn't that just a bit of stereotyping, lacrosse and rugby?" They had shared a laugh.
"I'm not even saying you should have told me you were in town," she had said. "All I'm saying is, at least let me know before the piece runs in the weekly. My people and I were embarrassed enough to get beat like that, especially by the legendary Cameron Williams. But for it to be a... well,
that's why you squealed on me?" Lucinda had laughed again. "That's why I told Plank it would take a face-to-face to get you back in my good graces."
"And what made you think I'd care about that?"
"Because you love me," she had said. "You can't help yourself." Buck had smiled.
"But, Cameron, if I catch you in my town again, on my beat, without my knowledge, I'm gonna whip your tail."
"Well, I'll tell you what, Lucinda. Let me give you a lead I don't have time to follow up on. I happen to know the NFL franchise purchase is not going to go through after all. The money was shaky, and the league's gonna reject the offer. Your local legend is going to be embarrassed."
Lucinda had begun scribbling furiously. "You're not serious," she had said, reaching for her phone.
"No, I'm not, but it was sure fun to see you swing into action."
"You creep," she had said. "Anybody else I'd be throwing out of here on his can."
"But you love me. You can't help yourself."
"That wasn't even Christian," she had said. "Don't start with that again."
"Come on, Cameron. You know you got your mind right when you saw what God did for Israel."
"Granted, but don't start calling me a Christian. Deist is as much as I'll cop to."
"Stay in town long enough to come to my church and God'll get you."
"He's already got me, Lucinda, but Jesus is another thing. The Israelis hate Jesus, but look what God did for them."
"The Lord works in mysterious ways. Yeah, I know.
Anyway, I'm going to London Monday, working on a hot tip from a friend there."
"Yeah, what?"
"Not on your life. We don't know each other that well yet."
She had laughed, and they had parted with a friendly embrace. That had been 3 days ago.
Buck had boarded the ill-fated flight to London, prepared for anything. He was following a tip from a former Princeton classmate, a Welshman who had been working in the London financial district since graduate school. Dirk Burton had been a reliable source in the past, tipping off Buck about secret high-level meetings among international financiers. For years, Buck had been slightly amused at Dirk's tendency to buy into conspiracy theories. "Let me get this straight," Buck had asked him once. "You think these guys are real-world leaders, right?"
"I wouldn't go that far, Cam," Dirk had said. "All I know is they're big, they're private, and after they meet, major things happen."
"So you think they get world leaders elected, hand-picked dictators, that kind of thing?"
"I don't belong to the conspiracy book club, if that's what you mean."
"Then where do you get this stuff, Dirk? Come on, you're a relatively sophisticated guy. Power brokers behind the scenes, movers and shakers who control the money."
"All I know is the London Exchange, the Tokyo Exchange, the New York Exchange. We all basically drift until these guys meet. Then things happen."
"You mean like when the New York Stock Exchange has a blip because of some presidential decision or some vote of Congress, it's really because of your secret group?"
"No, but that's a perfect example. If there's a blip in your market because of your president's health, imagine what it does to world markets when the real money people get together."
"But how does the market know they're meeting? I thought you were the only one who knew."
"Cam, be serious. Okay, not a lot of people agree with me, but then I don't say this to just anyone. One of our muckety-mucks is part of this group. When they have a meeting, no, nothing happens right away. But a few days later, a week, changes occur."
"Like what?"
"You're gonna call me crazy, but a friend of mine is related to a girl who works for the secretary of our guy in this group, and..."
"Whoa, hold it. What's the trail here?"
"Okay, maybe the connection is a little remote, but you know the old guy's secretary is not gonna say anything. Anyway, the scuttlebutt is that this guy is real hot on getting the whole world onto one currency.
You know, half our time is spent on exchange rates and all that. Takes computers forever to constantly readjust every day, based on the whims of the markets.
Buck was not convinced. One global currency? Never happen, he had said.
How can you flatly say that?
Too bizarre, too impractical. Look what happened in the States when they tried to bring in the metric system.
Should have happened. You Yanks are such rubes.
Metrics were only necessary for international trade. Not for how far it is to the outfield wall at Yankee Stadium or how many kilometers it is from Indianapolis to Atlanta.
I know, Cam. Your people thought you'd be paving the way for the communists to take over if you made maps and distance markers easy for them to read. And where are your commies now?
Buck had passed off most of Dirk Burton's ideas until a few years later, when Dirk had called him in the middle of the night.
Cameron, he had said, unaware of the nickname bestowed by his friend's colleagues, I can't talk long. You can pursue this, or you can just watch it happen and wish it had been your story. But you remember that stuff I was saying about the one world currency?
Yeah, I'm still dubious.
Fine, but I'm telling you the word here is that our guy pushed the idea at the last meeting of these secret financiers, and something's brewing.
What's brewing?
Well, there's going to be a major United Nations monetary conference, and the topic is going to be streamlining currency.
Big deal.
It is a big deal, Cameron. Our guy got shot down. He, of course, was pushing for world currency to become pound sterling.
What a surprise that that won't happen. Look at your economy.
But listen, the big news, if you can believe any leak out of the secret meeting, is that they have it down to three currencies for the entire world, hoping to go to just one inside a decade.
No way, won't happen.
Cameron, if my information is correct, the initial stage is a done deal. The UN conference is just window dressing.
And the decision has already been made by your secret puppeteers.
That's right.
I don't know, Dirk. You're a buddy, but I think you would rather be doing what I'm doing.
Who wouldn't?
Well, that's true. I sure wouldn't want to be doing what you're doing.
But I'm not wrong, Cameron. Test my information.
How?
I'll predict what's going to come out of the UN within 2 weeks, and if I'm right, you start treating me with a little deference, a little respect.
Buck realized that he and Dirk had been sparring the way everyone at Princeton had during weekend pizza and beer bashes in the dorms.
Dirk, listen. That sounds interesting, and I'm listening.
But you do know, don't you, all kidding aside, that I wouldn't think any less of you even if you were way off base here.
Well, thanks, Cam, really. That means a lot to me. And for that little tidbit, I'm going to give you a bonus. I'm not only going to tell you that the UN resolution is going to be for dollars, marks, and yen within 5 years, but I'm also going to tell you that the real power behind the power is an American.
What do you mean, the power behind the power?
The mightiest of the secret group of international money men.
This guy runs the group, in other words?
He's the one who shot down sterling as one of the currencies and has dollars in mind for the one-world commodity in the end.
I'm listening.
Jonathan Stonegal.
Buck had hoped Dirk would name someone ludicrous so he could burst into laughter, but he had to admit, if only to himself, that if there was anything to this, Stonegal would be a logical choice. One of the richest men in the world and long known as an American power broker, Stonegal would have to be involved if serious global finance was being discussed. Though he was already in his 80s and appeared infirm in news photos, he not only owned the biggest banks and financial institutions in the United States, but he also owned and had huge interests in the same throughout the world. Though Dirk was a friend, Buck had felt the need to play him along a bit, to keep him eager to provide information.
Dirk, I'm going back to bed. I appreciate all this and find it very interesting. I'm going to see what comes out of this UN deal, and I'm also going to see if I can trace the movements of Jonathan Stonegal. If it happens the way you think, you'll be my best informant.
Meanwhile, see if you can find out for me how many are in this secret group and where they meet.
That's easy, Dirk had said. There are at least 10, though more than that sometimes come to the meetings, including some heads of state.
U.S. presidents?
Occasionally, believe it or not.
That's sort of one of the popular conspiracy theories here, Dirk.
That doesn't mean it isn't true. And they usually meet in France. I don't know why. Some kind of private chalet or something there gives them a sense of security. But nothing escapes your friend of a friend of a relative of a subordinate of a secretary or whatever.
Laugh all you want, Cam. Our guy in the group, Joshua Todd Cothran, may just not be quite as buttoned down as the rest.
Todd Cothran? Doesn't he run the London Exchange?
That's the guy.
Not buttoned down? How could he have that position and not be? Plus, whoever heard of a Brit who wasn't buttoned down?
It happens.
Good night, Dirk. Of course it had all proven correct. The UN made its resolution. Buck discovered that Jonathan Stonegal had lived in the Plaza Hotel in New York during the 10 days of the confab. Mr. Todd Cothran of London had been one of the more eloquent speakers, expressing such eagerness to see the matter through that he volunteered to carry the torch back to the Prime Minister regarding Great Britain moving to the mark from the pound. Many Third World countries fought the change, but within a few years the three currencies had swept the globe. Buck had told only Steve Plank of his tip on the UN meetings, but he didn't say where he had gotten the information, and neither he nor Plank felt it worth a speculative article.
"Too risky," Steve had said.
Soon they both wished they had run with it in advance.
"You'd have become even more of a legend, Buck."
Dirk and Buck had become closer than ever, and it wasn't unusual for Buck to visit London on short notice. If Dirk had a serious lead, Buck packed and went. His trips had often turned into excursions into countries and climates that surprised him. Thus, he had packed the emergency gear. Now it appeared it was superfluous. He was stuck in Chicago after the most electrifying phenomenon in world history, trying to get to New York. Despite the incredible capabilities of his laptop, there was still no substitute for the pocket notebook. Buck scribbled a list of things to do before setting off again. Call Ken Ritz, charter pilot. Call Dad and Jeff. Call Hattie Durham with news of family. Call Lucinda Washington about local hotel. Call Dirk Burton. The phone awakened Rayford Steele. He hadn't moved for hours. It was early evening and beginning to get dark.
"Hello?"
he said, unable to mask the sleepy huskiness in his voice.
"Captain Steele?"
It was the frantic voice of Hattie Durham.
"Yes, Hattie. Are you all right?"
"I've been trying to reach you for hours. My phone was dead for the longest time, then everything was busy. I thought I was getting a ring on your phone, but you never answered. I don't know anything about my mother or my sisters. What about you?"
Rayford sat up, dizzy and disoriented.
"I got a message from Chloe," he said.
"I knew that," she said. "You told me at O'Hare. Are your wife and son all right?"
"No."
"No?"
Rayford was silent. What else was there to say?
"Do you know anything for sure?"
Hattie asked. "I'm afraid I do," he said. "Their bedclothes are here."
"Oh, no, Rayford, I'm sorry. Is there anything I can do?"
"No, thanks."
"Do you want some company?"
"No, thanks."
"I'm scared."
"So am I, Hattie."
"What are you going to do?"
"Keep trying to get Chloe. Hope she can come home or I can get to her."
"Where is she?"
"Stanford, Palo Alto."
"My people are in California, too," Hattie said. "They've got all kinds of trouble out there, even worse than here."
"I imagine it's because of the time difference," Rayford said. "More people on the roads, that sort of thing."
"I'm scared to death of what's become of my family."
"Let me know what you find out, Hattie, okay?"
I will, but you were supposed to call me. Of course, my phone was dead, and then I couldn't get through to you.
I wish I could say I tried to call you, Hattie, but I didn't. This is hard for me.
Let me know if you need me, Rayford. You know, just someone to talk to or be with.
I will. And you let me know what you find out about your family. He almost wished he hadn't added that. Losing his wife and child made him realize what a vapid relationship he had been pursuing with a 27-year-old woman. He hardly knew her, and he certainly didn't much care what happened to her family any more than he cared when he heard about a remote tragedy on the news. He knew Hattie was not a bad person. In fact, she was nice and friendly. But that was not why he had been interested in her. It had merely been a physical attraction, something he had been smart enough or lucky enough or naive enough not to have acted upon. He felt guilty for having considered it, and now his own grief would obliterate all but the most common courtesy of simply caring for a co-worker. "There's my call waiting," she said. "Can you hold?"
"No, just go ahead and take it. I'll call you later." "I'll call you back, Rayford."
"Well, okay." Buck Williams had gotten back in line and gained access to a payphone. This time he wasn't trying to hook up his computer to it. He simply wanted to see how many personal calls he could make. He reached Ken Ritz's answering machine first.
"This is Ritz's charter service. Here's the deal in light of the crisis. I've got Lear jets at both Palwaukee and Waukegan, but I've lost my other flyer. I can get to either airport, but right now they're not letting anyone into any of the major strips. Can't get into Milwaukee, O'Hare, Kennedy, Logan, National, Dulles, Dallas, Atlanta. I can get into some of the smaller, outlying airports, but it's a seller's market. Sorry to be so opportunistic, but I'm asking $2 a mile, cash up front. If I can find someone who wants to come back from where you're going, I might be able to give you a little discount. I'm checking this tape tonight, and we'll take off first thing in the morning. Longest trip with guaranteed cash gets me. If your stop is on the way, I'll try to squeeze you in. Leave me a message, and I'll get back to you."
That was a laugh. How would Ken Ritz get hold of Buck? With his cellular phone unreliable, the only thing he could think of was to leave his New York voicemail number.
"Mr. Ritz, my name is Buck Williams, and I need to get as close to New York City as you can get me. I'll pay the full fare you're asking in traveler's checks, redeemable in whatever currency you want."
Sometimes that was attractive to private contractors because they kept up with the differences in currency and could make a little margin on the exchange.
"I'm at O'Hare, and we'll try to find a place to stay in the suburbs. Just to save you time, let me just pick somewhere between here and Waukegan. If I get a new number in the meantime, I'll call it in. Meanwhile, you may leave a message for me at the following New York number."
Buck was still unable to get through to his office directly, but his voicemail number worked. He retrieved his new messages, mostly from co-workers checking on him and lamenting the loss of mutual friends. Then there was the welcome message from Marge Potter, who was a genius to think of leaving it there for him.
"Buck, if you get this, call your father in Tucson. He and your brother are together, and I hate to tell you here, but they're having trouble reaching Jeff's wife and the kids. They should have news by the time you call. Your father was most grateful to hear that you were all right."
Buck's voicemail also noted that he still had a saved message. That was the one from Dirk Burton that had spurred his trip in the first place. He would need to listen to it again when he had time. Meanwhile, he left a message for Marge that if she had time and an open line, she needed to let Dirk know Buck's flight never made it to Heathrow. Of course, Dirk would know that by now, but he needed to know Buck wasn't among the missing and that he would get there in due time. Buck hung up and dialed his father. The line was busy, but it wasn't the same kind of a tone that tells you the lines are down or that the whole system is kaput. Neither was it that irritating recording he'd grown so used to. He knew it would be only a matter of time before he could get through. Jeff must be beside himself not knowing about his wife, Sharon, and the kids. that had their differences and had even been separated before the children came along, but for several years the marriage had been better. Jeff's wife had proven forgiving and conciliatory. Jeff himself admitted he was puzzled that she would take him back. "Call me undeserving, but grateful," he once told Buck. Their son and daughter, who both looked like Jeff, were precious. Buck pulled out the number the beautiful blonde flight attendant had given him and chastised himself for not trying again to reach her earlier. It took a while for her to answer. "Hattie Durham, this is Buck Williams."
"Who?"
"Cameron Williams from the Global..."
"Oh, yes. Any news?"
"Yes, ma'am. Good news."
"Oh, thank God. Tell me."
"Someone from my office tells me they reached your mother and that she and your sisters are fine."
"Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. I wonder why they haven't called here. Maybe they've tried. My phone has been haywire."
"There are other problems in California, ma'am. Lines down, that kind of thing. It may be a while before you can talk to them."
"I know, I heard. Well, I sure appreciate this. How about you? Have you been able to reach your family?"
"I got word that my dad and brother are okay. We still don't know about my sister-in-law and the kids."
"Oh, how old are the kids?"
"Can't remember. Both under 10, but I don't know exactly."
"Oh."
Hattie sounded sad, guarded.
"Why?"
Buck asked.
"Oh, nothing. It's just that..."
"What?"
"You can't go by what I say."
"Tell me, Miss Durham."
"Well, you remember what I told you on the plane. And on the news, it looks like all children are gone, even unborn ones."
"Yeah."
"I'm not saying that means your brother's children are..."
"I know."
"I'm sorry I brought that up."
"No, it's okay. This is too strange, isn't it?"
"Yeah. I just got off the phone with the captain who piloted the flight you were on. He lost his wife and son, but his daughter is okay. She's in California, too."
"How old is she?"
"About 20, I guess. She's at Stanford."
"Oh."
"Mr. Williams, what did you call yourself?"
"Buck. It's a nickname."
"Well, Buck, I know better than to say what I said about your niece and nephew. I hope there are exceptions and that yours are okay."
She began to cry. "Miss Durham, it's okay. You have to admit, no one is thinking straight right now."
"You can call me Hattie."
That struck him as humorous under the circumstances. She had been apologizing for being inappropriate, yet she didn't want to be too formal. If he was Buck, she was Hattie. "I suppose I shouldn't tie up this line," he said. "I just wanted to get the news to you. I thought maybe by now you already knew."
"No, and thanks again. Would you mind calling me again sometime if you think of it? You seem like a nice person, and I appreciate what you did for me. It would be nice to hear from you again. This is kind of a scary, lonely time."
He couldn't argue with that understatement. Funny, her request had sounded like anything but a come-on. She seemed wholly sincere, and he was sure she was. A nice, scared, lonely woman whose world had been skewed just like his and everyone's he knew. When Buck got off the phone, he saw the young woman at the counter flagging him down.
"Listen," she whispered. "They don't want me making an announcement that would start a stampede, but we just heard something interesting. The livery companies have gotten together and moved their communication center out to a median strip near the Mannheim Road interchange."
"Where's that?"
"Just outside the airport. There's no traffic coming into the terminals anyway. Total gridlock. But if you can walk as far as that interchange, supposedly you'll find all those guys with walkie-talkies trying to get limos in and out from there."
"I can imagine the prices."
"No, you probably can't."
"I can imagine the wait."
"Like standing in line for a rental car in Orlando," she said.
Buck had never done that, but he could imagine that, too. And she was right. After he had hiked, with a crowd, to the Mannheim interchange, he found a mob surrounding the dispatchers. Intermittent announcements got everyone's attention.
"We're filling every car. $100 a head to any suburb, cash only. Nothing's going to Chicago.
No cards, someone shouted. I'll say it again, the dispatcher said. Cash only. If you know you've got cash or a checkbook at home, you can plead with the driver to trust you till you get there.
He called out a listing of which companies were heading which directions. Passengers ran to fill the cars as they lined up on the shoulder of the expressway. Buck handed $100 traveler's check to the dispatcher for the northern suburbs. An hour and a half later, he joined several others in a limo. After checking his cellular phone again to no avail, he offered the driver $50 to use his phone.
No guarantees, the driver said. Sometimes I get through, sometimes I don't.
Buck checked the phone log in his laptop for Lucinda Washington's home number and dialed. A teenage boy answered.
Washington's.
Cameron Williams of Global Weekly calling for Lucinda.
My mom's not here, the young man said.
Is she still at the office? I need a recommendation where to stay near Waukegan.
She's nowhere, the boy said. I'm the only one left. Mama, Daddy, everybody else is gone. Disappeared.
Are you sure?
Their clothes are here, right where they were sitting. My daddy's contact lenses are still on top of his bathrobe.
Oh, man, I'm sorry, son.
That's all right. I know where they are, and I can't even say I'm surprised.
You know where they are?
If you know my mama, you know where she is, too. She's in heaven.
Yeah, well, are you all right? Is there someone to look after you?
My uncle's here, and a guy from our church, probably the only one who's still around.
You're all right, then?
I'm all right.
Cameron folded the phone and handed it back to the driver. Any idea where I should stay if I'm trying to fly out of Waukegan in the morning?
The chain hotels are probably full, but there's a couple of flea bags on Washington you might sneak into. You'd be close enough to the airport. You'd be my last drop-off.
Fair enough. They got phones in those dives?
More likely a phone and a TV than running water.
Chapter 6. It had been ages since Rayford Steele had been drunk. Irene had never been much of a drinker, and she had become a teetotaler during the last few years. She insisted he hide any hard stuff if he had to have it in the house at all. She didn't want Ramey even knowing his daddy still drank.
That's dishonest, Rayford had countered.
It's prudent, she said. He doesn't know everything, and he doesn't have to know everything.
How does that jibe with your insistence that we be totally truthful?
Telling the whole truth doesn't always mean telling everything you know. You tell your crew you're taking a bathroom break, but you don't go into detail about what you're doing in there, do you?
Irene.
I'm just saying you don't have to make it obvious to your preteen son that you drink hard liquor.
He had found her point hard to argue, and he had kept his bourbon stashed high and out of sight. If ever there was a moment that called for a stiff drink, this was it. He reached behind the empty cake cover in the highest cabinet over the sink and pulled down a half-finished fifth of whiskey. His inclination, knowing no one he cared about would ever see, was to tip it straight up and guzzle. But even at a time like this, there were conventions and manners. Guzzling booze from the bottle was simply not his style. Rayford poured 3 inches into a wide crystal glass and threw it back like a veteran. That was about as out of character as he could find comfortable. The stuff hit the back of his throat and burned all the way down, giving him a chill that made him shudder and groan.
What an idiot, he thought, and on an empty stomach, too.
He was already getting a buzz when he replaced the bottle, then thought better of it. He slipped it into the garbage under the sink. Would this be a nice memorial to Irene, giving up even the occasional hard drink? There would be no benefit to Ramey now, but he didn't feel right about drinking alone anyway. Did he have the capacity to become a closet drunk? Who doesn't, he wondered. Regardless, he wasn't going to cash in his maturity because of what had happened.
Rayford's sleep had been deep, but not long enough. He had few immediate chores. First, he had to connect with Chloe. Second, he had to find out what Pan Khan wanted from him in the next week. Normal regulations would have grounded him after an overly long flight and a rerouted emergency landing. But who knew what was going on now? How many pilots had they lost? When would runways be cleared? Flights scheduled? If he knew anything about the airlines, it would all be about dollars. As soon as they could get those machines airborne, they could start being profitable again. Well, Pan Khan had been good to him. He would hang in there and do his part. But what was he supposed to do about his grief, this despair, this empty ache? Finally, he understood the bereaved who complained when their loved one was too mangled to see or whose body had been destroyed. They often complained that there was no sense of closure and that the grieving process was more difficult because they had a hard time imagining their loved one actually dead. That had always seemed strange to him. Who would want to see a wife or child stretched out and made up for a funeral? Wouldn't you want to remember them alive and happy as they were? But he knew better now. He had no doubt that his wife and son were gone as surely as if they had died, as his own parents had years before. Irene and Ray would not be coming back, and he didn't know if he would ever see them again, because he didn't know if there were second chances on this heaven thing. He longed to be able to see their bodies, at least, in bed, in a casket, anywhere. He would have given anything for one last glimpse. It wouldn't have made them any less dead to him, but maybe he wouldn't feel so abandoned, so empty. Rayford knew there would not likely be phone connections between Illinois and California for hours, maybe days, yet he had to try. He dialed Stanford, the main administration number, and didn't even get a busy signal or a recorded message. He dialed Chloe's room, still nothing. Every half hour or so, he hit the redial button. He refused to hope she would answer. If she did, it would be a wonderful surprise. Rayford found himself ravenous and knew he'd better get something in his stomach before the few ounces of booze did a number on him. He mounted the stairs again, stopping in Raimi's room to pick up the little pile of clothes by which he would remember the boy. He put them in a cardboard gift box he found in Irene's closet, then placed her nightgown, locket, and ring in another. He took the boxes downstairs, along with the two cookies she had mailed him. The rest of that batch of cookies had to be around somewhere. He found them in a Tupperware bowl in the cupboard. He was grateful that their smell and taste would remind him of her until they were gone. Rayford added a couple to the two he had brought down, put them on a paper plate, and poured himself a glass of milk. He sat at the kitchen table next to the phone, but couldn't force himself to eat. He felt paralyzed. To busy himself, he erased the calls on the answering machine and added a new outgoing message. He said, "This is Rayford Steele. If you must, please leave a very brief message. I am trying to leave this line open for my daughter. Chloe, if it's you, I'm either sleeping or close by, so give me a chance to pick up. If we don't connect for some reason, do whatever you have to get home. Any airline can charge it to me. I love you." And with that, he slowly ate his cookies, the smell and taste bringing images to him of Irene in the kitchen and the milk making him long for his boy. This was going to be hard, so hard. He was exhausted, and yet he couldn't bring himself to go upstairs again. He knew he would have to force himself to sleep in his own bedroom that night. For now, he would stretch out on the couch in the living room and hope Chloe would get through. He idly pushed the redial button again, and this time he got the quick, busy signal that told him something was happening. At the very least, lines were being worked on. That was progress. He knew she was thinking of him while he was thinking of her. But she had no idea what might have happened to her mother or her brother. Would he have to tell her by phone? He feared he would. She would surely ask. He lumbered to the couch and lay down, a sob in his throat, but no more tears to accompany it.
If only Chloe would somehow get his message and get started home, he could at least tell her face to face. Rayford lay there grieving, knowing the television would be full of scenes he didn't want to see, dedicated around the clock to the tragedy and mayhem all over the world. And then it hit him. He sat up, staring out the window in the darkness. He owed it to Chloe not to fail her. He loved her, and she was all he had left. He had to find out how they had missed everything Irene had been trying to tell them, why it had been so hard to accept and believe. Above all, he had to study, to learn, to be prepared for whatever happened next. If the disappearances were of God, if they had been his doing, was this the end of it? The Christians, the real believers, get taken away, and the rest are left to grieve and mourn and realize their error? Maybe so. Maybe that was the price. But then what happens when we die, he thought. If heaven is real, if the rapture was a fact, what does that say about hell and judgment? Is that our fate? We go through this hell of regret and remorse, and then we literally go to hell too? Irene had always talked of a loving God, but even God's love and mercy had to have limits. Had everyone who denied the truth pushed God to his limit? Was there no more mercy? No second chance? Maybe there wasn't. And if that was so, that was so. But if there were options, if there was still a way to find the truth and believe or accept or whatever it was Irene said one was supposed to do, Rayford was going to find it. Would it mean admitting that he didn't know everything? That he had relied on himself and that now he felt stupid and weak and worthless? He could admit that. After a lifetime of achieving, of excelling, of being better than most and the best in most circles, he had been as humbled as was possible in one stroke. There was so much he didn't know, so much he didn't understand. But if the answers were still there, he would find them. He didn't know whom to ask or where to start, but this was something he and Chloe could do together. They'd always gotten along all right. She had gone through the typical teenage independence, but she had never done anything stupid or irreparable as far as he knew. In fact, they had probably been too close. She was too much like him. It was simply Raimi's age and innocence that had allowed his mother's influence to affect him so. It was his spirit. He didn't have the killer instinct, the me-first attitude Rayford thought he would need to succeed in the real world. He wasn't effeminate, but Rayford had worried that he might be a mama's boy, too compassionate, too sensitive, too caring. He was always looking out for someone else when Rayford thought he should be looking out for number one. How grateful he was now that Raimi took after his mother more than he took after his father, and how he wished there had been some of that in Chloe. She was competitive, a driver, someone who had to be convinced and persuaded. She could be kind and generous when it suited her purpose, but she was like her dad. She took care of herself. "Good job, Big Shot," Rayford told himself. "The girl you were so proud of because she was so much like you is in your same predicament." That, he decided, would have to change. As soon as they reconnected, that would change. They would be on a mission, a quest for truth. If he was already too late, he would have to accept and deal with that. He had always been one who went for a goal and accepted the consequences, only these consequences